and the way that that can be seen probably more accurately is still consciousness, the consciousness of stillness, and then just how that, how all of that works, and how it plays into this external world and the world that we kind of live with. Because it is very much a paradox, isn't it, this paradox of me, Dennis, and then the others, you. And for you, it's exactly the same thing. You know, you're looking out into this world and you're seeing me and all the other people in the hall as well, but this is what you're seeing is from your perspective, from your mind. This is your mind, the same as when I'm looking out here at what I'm kind of viewing from this perspective. This is my mind. And in reality, in the end, it comes down to us all to be able to make our own minds peaceful. Because in reality, I can't make your mind peaceful. Ajahn Brahm can't make your mind peaceful. Ajahn Brahm certainly does, and can and does certainly give a lot of advice and points the way, and we can do that. But in reality, in the end, it's really each one of us for ourselves in that way to sort of see the world in the way it is, to see how this paradox of the interconnectedness of everything, the way that we are all connected together, we all build this universe together. But yet at the same time, it's a very personal experience and a personal happening. And when the Buddha talked about this, he there was this Pali word that he used, ahipassiko, which means come and see. He kind of asked everybody to do that, to come and look for yourself at this mind. Don't kind of take it on faith or to learn a dogma about it or anything like that. And because that's in actual fact how we've really come to see the world in the way that it is, how we've been conditioned into that. And that conditioning is very, very, it's very hard to see how we do get conditioned from the very time that we're very young. And it's not only that, it's in Buddhism, it's through all past lives. And, you know, we've been really learning about this universe over many, many lifetimes. So it's not surprising that it's a very, when you look out into this external world, that it is so compelling, so hard to sort of to see in the right way. But anyway, we will look at all of that and just see where we can get to. But in the meantime, we'll do some meditation for half an hour or so, and I would like to just, as I'm guiding this, just allow you to sort of see some of the things that we're talking about here as we look into our mind. And I'll start off just by grounding, doing a normal grounding, which, you know, I love to do actually, just because the second foundation of mindfulness is feeling, learning how to feel. And I have found over my life that it's very difficult for some people to actually know what a feeling is. But just feeling into the body. So the first foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the body, and we'll do that first off, and then we'll also look at this second factor of mindfulness, second foundation of mindfulness, which is the mindfulness of feeling. So feeling into the body. So this is a very important sort of part of the meditation practice, just to do that side of it, and then later on we'll move into just very quickly go on to the third factor, which is mindfulness of mind. So we're going to look at that too, mindfulness of mind. That's the third factor of mindfulness. And then mindfulness of the phenomena of mind. That's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So those four foundations are really what really make up the way that we see mindfulness to be, and those four foundations are really important to try and understand what being mindful is. And mindful is really the first foundation of enlightenment, so it's very important. So we'll start off, and one other thing that perhaps I'd just like to mention too, because I will as I say, do this grounding, little grounding exercise, but also just to let you know that this grounding exercise does move out into the universe as well, because you may or may not know that physics, anyway, the scientists of today for many years now have known that all of the elements in our body are made from stars. So every element that's heavier than iron is actually made inside a star, and it's made actually when the when we have these vast supernova explosions, and they seed the space out there with these heavier elements, the heavier elements in the periodic table. And really, they're the only way that it can be made. I think elements can be forged up to iron, you know, in normal ways of doing it here on the Earth. But the reality is that all of the elements that make up our body come from the universe. We are literally children of the stars. So I like to include that into the grounding part of the meditation, just so that it gives us a bit of a foundation for just understanding what it is that we're working with, so that when you're actually sitting there doing your meditation, you're really sitting there with the whole universe with you there as well. So, if you just like to find a nice, comfortable spot, just getting the back nice and straight with that nice little bend in the back of the lower back, and just the head pointing to the top of the ceiling. Close the eyes, close the mouth, and just let your tongue rest gently against the palate. And then also just starting to breathe through your nose. And you've got your right hand usually on your left. It's a good way to have it. And once again, when I'm kind of teaching this myself, I usually like to have my hands fairly loosely, not too tightly clenched together. And in that way, you get a bit of a feel for the energy that's around your fingers, because there's a lot of energy around your fingers, and you can sort of feel when we get to it, you'll hopefully be able to feel that little bit of tingling that's there. So just first of all, see yourself sitting and just breathing normally. Then I'd like you just to put your attention on your feet, and you can even, if you like, just pick one of your toes. You might even want to be wild and pick, say, your fourth toe. Just see if you can feel that. You might be able to feel it against your little toe, or perhaps against the, if you're wearing socks, any fabric that's there. But just put your attention into there just to feel it. You can pick any toe really, but just feeling into your toes. And then as you're doing that, just let the attention then run over the arch of your foot. So just feeling your arch of the foot and then running into the heel. And oftentimes around there, I can often feel just the thickness of the skin and even sometimes the roughness of my heels that will often need to be filed down. Then just letting your attention come up through the ankle, which sort of in a way articulates and holds your foot onto your lower leg, then moving the attention up through into the shins and up into the calf muscles. And again, with these two things, they're really like chalk and cheese, your shins and your calves. Your calves are usually fairly soft and floppy, and shins you can feel maybe quite hard. And I think it's important just to see how much you can feel. See, just practice to feel what that's like. And then bringing your attention up to your knees and the way that that's bent. And anywhere through this process, if there's any tension that's there, just let it relax. And then just the bending of the knee. And then up through into your thighs, the big thigh muscles. Strength that's there. And then moving through your bottom, which is, you can usually feel the pressure of how it's sitting in whichever way you're sitting. And then up into the lower back and the tummy. Just feeling that nice energy that's sort of flowing into your body as you're starting to relax. You can feel that your body's starting to relax as you're paying attention to it. And then around the tummy, sometimes you can, especially after you've just eaten, you can usually sense and feel a lot of things going on in there, different movements and gurgles. Then moving up into the upper back, around the shoulder blades and the chest. And in the chest, there's certainly lots of rhythms that go on there, the rhythms of the heart, little pulses. And then feeling from your shoulder blades and how that's all connected into your arms. And then you've got your upper arms and through the elbows into the forearms, through the wrists and into the hands and the fingers. And now you might even be able to feel, just if you've got your fingers just and your hands just gently clasped. Can you feel any tingling around the tips of your fingers, just where the nerves are working? Almost like an effervescent fizz. I like to linger around here too, because you can sometimes get a sense of what that feels like and then go to another part of your body, could be any part, and just notice on the surface there, and you'll oftentimes find that same effervescent feeling, that fizzy feeling. And you get the idea of how the body itself is like a ball of energy. And when you start to feel all that, you can be very confident that your body's starting to relax. Your mind's starting to relax as well, just because your body is. And then we can move our attention up into the neck area and up into the head, around the lips and behind the eyes, just noticing if there's any tension. And just allowing it all to relax. And up around the top of the head. And then just to see yourself sitting. And you are anchored into this earth. You can feel just the gentleness of the way gravity holds you. It's holding you into your seat. you can intuit that this gravity and these field lines that are sort of holding you are anchoring you to the earth. And we can reflect that we are from this earth. We eat up all the food from the earth that grows in the earth. The proteins and the all the good elements and good food that we eat are all part of us and part of the earth. And then just allowing that realization to extend out into the out into space. Just noticing or knowing that there's a sun that's out there and a moon and all of the planets. And all that is held in gravitational attraction. And indeed we're inside a galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. And that galaxy is in a cluster of galaxies. They call that our local group. And then beyond that there's other galaxies. More than you can count. And we're part of all of that as well. Can even reflect that as you're sitting here on this seat, that this universe is sitting here with us. We're part of it. And then just allow yourself to notice your breath. Just as if you're standing guard at your nose. And just allowing yourself to see the way the breath is coming in and then flowing out. Just like myself, just to reflect on the wondrous nature of that, just the way that this miracle of the breath works. This miracle of the breath coming into our body. Servicing all the parts of our body. Keeping us alive. Wonderful, beautiful breath. Just there, all of the time, all the time that we're alive. For 72 years now, this breath has served me. It allows me to bring up gratitude and wonder. And you can just allow yourself to absorb more deeply into the breath, just starting to leave the body and the world behind and just paying attention to the breath. the way that it's flowing in, and the way that it's flowing out. And you can start just to notice, as you're becoming more involved with the breath, you're becoming more absorbed into the breath, just how the mind is starting to relax. You can notice that there's a contentment there in your mind. The mind isn't going out to grasp anything now. Well, it's not trying to push anything away. So there's no desire and there's no aversion. So those first two hindrances are starting to abate. And you can notice what contentment feels like. Just what does that feel like to have the mind relaxing into contentment? Contentment with the breath. And you can also notice that the mind isn't restless. And you're not tired. You're awake and you're aware. Just watching the breath. So there's a nice balance of energy there that's feeding into the contentment. This is the third and the fourth hindrance that's starting to come into balance. And because all of that is working, there's no space at the moment for any doubts. So we can notice how the five hindrances are settling, just allowing us to be content, relaxed and peaceful as we absorb more deeply into the breath. And then just as you're watching the breath, you might be starting to notice that there's stillness coming into your mind. You can notice that the mind isn't thinking. And certainly with the words that I'm speaking, you don't have to try and work them out or think about the words. Just see them as words coming into your mind and starting and ending, beginning and ending. No need to try and make any commentary on them. Just allow the mind to be still. And feel what that's like. The breath is beginning and it's ending in that still consciousness of mind, that stillness that's just there, that beautiful contentment. We're starting to relax and absorb more deeply, becoming more concentrated, moving towards what the Buddha called samadhi. The hindrances are abating and disappearing. No desires, no aversion. And the energy is coming into balance. And we're just watching. We're watching in the stillness. You might be watching the breath, beginning and ending, all in the stillness of your mind. And the words that I'm speaking, they're also beginning and ending in the stillness of your mind. And the stillness, you might notice that it's quite a familiar feeling, but maybe you haven't really noticed it well before. Just notice how it is quite familiar, because it's there with you all of the time. It's always right there in the heart of the present moment. And it is possible to follow your breath to the stillness. No movement of mind at all, no thoughts. No feelings really either, except just the feeling of the breath, because you can start to notice just the way that it resounds, the way that it feels when it's resounding so fast. almost like it's singing at you. And the still consciousness is just there all of the time. And you can notice that all of the conditions, they begin and they end in that stillness. And that stillness is in the heart of the present moment. And then as you start to really understand and be with that stillness, you can start to see the beauty of it. To feel that subtle joy, the piety of just being still, relaxed. So compelling. We can even say that we're moving into the heart of the universe. Because it's all right there in the stillness. And because it is in the heart of the stillness, it's very, very close to truth. The truth of the present moment. Again, can you notice what that stillness feels like? And to know that we're looking right into the heart of our mind. Because it is this stillness that provides the boundaries of our mind. It's in the stillness that all the conditions come and go. as you are absorbing into that stillness, even past the breath, past all of the conditions. You can even get to the point where your body and the universe and the world just falls away as you go more deeply into the stillness. And the beauty that can be found there. The rapture and the joy. Beauty. So subtle. So compelling. In a moment I'm going to ring the bell just to end the meditation. And I'll do that three times as usual. But over that period of the resonance of the bell, I would just ask you just to reflect on what's happened for you. And especially as you come back to this room, come back to this world and this room, see if you can bring the stillness back with you, keeping the mind still. Powerful. And then as you open your eyes, just notice how the seeing consciousness is there in the stillness, is there in your mind, and all of the senses. All part of this sixth sense of mind. So I trust everybody got a taste of that stillness. It's a very wonderful and powerful thing, meditation. And especially the way that the Buddha taught it. The way that he structured things is just so, well, for me anyway, when I read through the teachings and the little lists of things that he made, just like what I was running through with you there, the five hindrances. You know, so he, for just about any condition, the Buddha made a list of things for us to follow. Really quite wonderful the way that we can use the way that he taught like this to really get an idea and have a way of following the pathway that he took into understanding what this mind is, which is of course the topic of tonight's talk, just understanding the mind. And starting off from that way of doing things in that mindful in that exploration of mindfulness there, really, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind itself, and mindfulness of the phenomena of the mind. It's really a great way to sort of start this way of understanding the Buddha's teachings, because just in those four things, we've got the very first foundation of enlightenment right there. There's seven of those, seven factors of enlightenment, but this mindfulness is really so important, and it's the way that it's that we use this in the way that we can investigate. Investigation, as it turns out, just happens to be the second factor of enlightenment. So mindfulness is the first factor, then investigation is the second factor. And indeed, we were doing that in this practice tonight, just doing investigation, looking into the mind, just seeing from a very still place just how the whole thing, how it does work, how it's there, in just a, well, really a beautiful way. Because I mean it's fairly, I think, easy for us to understand what this present moment is really so powerful. We all know in a way that the past is sort of gone, and you know, as Ajahn Brahm talks about, when you think about things from the past, you're really bringing corpses around with you. You're bringing the corpses of yesterday and last year and the years before that, putting them all on your back and walking around with them. When we kind of we linger and stay in the past, and the same with the future. When we think about the future, it's something that hasn't come yet. So when we're thinking about the future, we're not present at all. We might be anxious about it, or have expectations about what might happen. But all of those things, in fact, we don't really even know if the sun's going to come up tomorrow. It's one of my favourite kind of ways of seeing this, because it really just hasn't come yet. So, you know, the past is finished, and the future really is yet to come. So this present moment, and the way that we live our lives across the present moment, in a way, I see it a little bit like, it's like a blur, isn't it? The way it's a blurry kind of a situation as we kind of straddle over the present moment, really, to live our lives, bringing the past into the future without kind of really even noticing the present moment. But this meditation is so brilliant because it allows us to go deeply into the present moment, to be able to see, well, first of all, the stillness that's there, and to understand how important that still consciousness is. And just working with that still consciousness, just to notice how all the conditions, all the conditioning that we have in our lives, where that how that sort of all comes out of the stillness. Because most of us don't really know how we got there. I mean, I can sort of think back of some formative times in my life where I know that certain things or happenings that I've done have caused me to sort of think or be certain ways, in a certain way. But most of us don't really know. We're just here. We've got a mind, and we've got all these views and opinions that have been conditioned into us, mostly probably in the first instance through our parents, who very lovingly, hopefully, looked after us all. In fact, the Dalai Lama often talks about where compassion comes from in human beings, and he often talks about that as coming from parents who... because it is, you know, whenever we're doing loving kindness meditation, it's always, you know, I always kind of like to think of little babies and helpless creatures, helpless. Ajahn Brahm thinks about animals, helpless animals. And we can sort of develop compassion by kind of seeing the ways of nurturing them and being with them. And that's what our parents do, isn't it? They kind of nurtured us and really inculcated a little bit of that compassion into us. So that's really a very good bit of conditioning. But then, you know, as you think, as the you're going on, you certainly take on a lot of your parents' views and opinions about things, I guess, until you maybe have the ability to test them a bit more later on. But all of these things go in quite blindly, don't they? We're never really quite aware of when this conditioning comes into us or when you're seeing. I mean, as a hypnotherapist, I sort of see this all of the time, you know, and just in the way that you kind of work with people who've got traumas of that, you know, what we tend to do in hypnosis is sort of move the conscious mind out of the way so that just the subconscious mind is there for us, and then you can give the subconscious mind suggestion, which it will take on. The subconscious mind is really very childlike. It's kind of guileless in a way. So I just, you know, whatever kind of is said into the subconscious mind will just tend to just be there, because we don't question it, because the conscious mind is out of the way. It's the conscious mind that, you know, like when you're a child and you see a fire, you know, it's likely you'll go over and put your hand near the fire until your parents pull you away and say, no, that's dangerous, don't do that. And gradually, consciously, you learn that that's a dangerous thing to do. And various things like that we kind of learn in the way that we're conditioned. And that goes into our conscious mind, and it's our conscious mind that really is all the time sort of keeping us safe in a way. But the tapes that are in there, if you like, if that's a way of seeing it, the tapes that are in there are really more like subconscious. We don't really see how they're driving us, you know, and quite often these subconscious traumas or troubles that we have inside us, they're kind of pushing and pulling us around without us really even knowing, because they're just kind of locked inside. But how they got there, well, I mean, in my practice, a lot of people have the insight that they come from past lives, which it's certainly some of them do. Some of them come from trouble in childhood or traumas that we've had earlier in life. But certainly past lives do play a part in that, so that very often the work that I do there is around making these subconscious movements of mine more visible for people, and giving suggestions in ways of being able to release it, relax it. And of course, meditation really does that too, doesn't it? We're kind of, as you go, you've probably even noticed in your own meditation, I certainly did in my early practice with meditation, did notice really just how, as my mind became more still, I was really quite surprised to see some of the things that just popped up in my mind that have been there for so long. You know, ideas and views and opinions that I had from a child, and you know, there they were, or traumas, or little hurts and niggles that I'd had from right back then. But they're all just in there, and it's amazing how they just sit inside you, and we don't even know half the time. So this meditation really is a way of being able to know yourself. You know, that self-reflective ability that we do have once we can get the meditation working right, it is a very good way of learning to understand the conditioning that we have and learning to understand how we are conditioned, to notice that we are conditioned beings, conditioned people. And mostly we don't really even know that. I mean, advertisers and all of those people, they know that they kind of, this constant bombardment with commercial advertising all of the time is really quite insidious for us. You know, you might be sitting watching a film or something like that, quite absorbed into the film or relaxed, and all of a sudden the ad comes on and it's, Kellogg's cornflakes are good for you. They make you strong, healthy. And you don't really even notice that that's been said, but that goes in subconsciously. But the next time you're down the supermarket, you're walking along and there's the same packet that's there on was there on the TV. It's there, Kellogg's cornflakes, I've always liked those. I'll buy a pack of those because I know they're good for me. That's kind of how this conditioning sort of works, you know, and advertising and advertisers know that, or people that are people that use psychology in that way to, I suppose in a way it's manipulating, but in a way it's also the bread and butter of life, isn't it? All of this sort of thing, you know, what sort of cars we like, or what we like to do, the dance crazes, the different things that we do. It's all sort of tied up into this conditioning that we have, but we don't really know too much about that. It is all really quite blind to us until we start to look. So we start to look and understand how all of that works. Because as the Buddha talks about in the Eightfold Path, the very first factor of the Eightfold Path is right view. And now getting the right view can be quite difficult, really. Right view is always talked about, but in actual fact, where I'm going to tonight in this question of just understanding our mind, that's really all on the path to understand the right view. Where is the mind? You know, is it something that's outside there? Is it something that's always there, that when we die, we're just finished with this world? There's no more world left. We're just dead, just finished. Is that true? Well, the Buddha never entertained that. In fact, I think in the last talk I gave here, I finished with a stanza, a little poem that comes from the Dhammapada. I think it's verse 21 of the Dhammapada that says, heedfulness is the pathway to the deathless. Heedlessness is forever dying. Those that are heedful do not die, but those that are heedless are forever dying. So there's something in those words, and they're the Buddha's words. That's the stanza that the Buddha wrote in the Dhammapada. So you can see there that he's really pointing to this mindfulness as something that's really very important for us to see and understand. You know, where is this world? Is it something that's that just is finished when we die? Or is the mind something more than that? And then as you're starting to look deeply into your mind, just as we were in the meditation, you will have noticed too, if you were lucky enough, and hopefully some of you were able to sort of see the stillness of your mind, you start to realise that this stillness is really something that's always there. It's never ever not there. So just when you're kind of looking at the conditions of mind, or if you like the phenomena of the mind, which is the fourth factor of mindfulness, you can see that a lot of these conditions that come and go in your minds, oftentimes they have very, very small scales up to very, very large scales. You know, you can look at a breath. You've got the stillness that you can see there, but you've just in the stillness, there's a breath begins. So a breath begins, and then a breath finishes. And then that finishing conditions a new breath, and it begins, comes to its apex or its point of not going any further, and then it finishes, and that conditions are new. So the conditioning goes on and on. It's a habitual process that we've kind of learned over many, many lifetimes. So you can look at that as a breath, but then you can look at other conditions that we construct in our minds, like maybe a day. So a day might be, it's a bit longer than a breath. Maybe many breaths in a day, but the day might begin and then it ends. But then a new day is conditioned. And a year. And then you can go on in a lifetime. we all remember when we don't really remember when we're born, but we kind of all know that we're going to die. But that's, again, a process too. When the Buddha was asked just where this consciousness began, you know, as I've sort of mentioned a couple of times, and I like reading a lot of the physics and different things like that. So I kind of appreciate when the Buddha's talking about stuff like that. When he was asked about consciousness, he said that by his monks, he said that he'd looked back over 24 kalpas and he said no beginning could be seen. And a kalpa in the Pali language is a universal cycle. So here we have a very, very long, element of conditioning, haven't we? You know, how far does a universal cycle begins with supposedly 14,000 million years now into this current universal cycle since the so-called Big Bang? And, you know, so we may be here, but is it going to sort of peak over here somewhere, and where does it finish? Right over there. But the stillness is always there. The still consciousness is always there. It's the consciousness that the still consciousness that allows these creations to be, the consciousness of mind. And for me, when I kind of think about that, and for you too, I would hope that if you can get some idea of what having this consciousness there in your mind is, if you can sort of practice to have it there, it's an excellent datum. A datum point, a place where you can reflect from, you know. So instead of just being lost in the movement of your life, just the way that's being pushed around by your conditioning, instead of that, if you can know this stillness and know it all of the time there in your mind, you've always got a datum to the present moment. You've got a datum to truth. A date into where all of this starts from, begins from. And this truth, this still consciousness that gives us the ability to be so creative in the world. I notice now even it's a bit worrying sometimes too, because very clever people now are starting to kind of twig on to all of this with quantum mechanics and various things like this. People are, you know, realising that you can really change your life quite profoundly, really, just by sort of knowing and understanding some of these deeper knowledges that are there in just in the way the mind works and in the way that we can change ourselves when we start to understand the way that we work so habitually with what we've got inside us. But oftentimes, you know, these people that sort of see things this way, they haven't really got the first noble truth in mind, oftentimes. And the first noble truth of dukkha really is, the Buddha was sort of pointing to the fact that this world that we're living in, I mean, as good as it might be and as beautiful, and certainly it's incumbent on us all to try and make it as peaceful and as happy as we can, to make our lives happy and joyful. But is it, you know, if we use this this consciousness to create, to continuously create. You know, I often think about this with this earth, you know, the earth with all the trouble we've got with climate change and the way that the abysmal way we seem to think about animals and their habitat and things like that, where we just willy-nilly sort of change their habitat and cause all sorts of trouble for the animals and the creatures of the earth. And yet we do all that, but at the same time we're wanting to create the process of, say, going to Mars. Let's go to another planet. And, you know, I just wonder about the wisdom of all of that. You know, Is that wise, or should we really be looking back to see how we can understand this as the way the Buddha talked about it, as dukkha? Dukkha being unsatisfactory. So he's saying that this life is unsatisfactory. In fact, the Buddha says, I've sort of mentioned it in one of the talks I've given recently, just where the Buddha says, you know, the house of self is on fire, and get out as soon as you can. But that's because the more you get sort of caught up into this movement into the external world like that, you kind of get lost. And it's very difficult to come back to see the conditioning and to see what you're actually doing there. But this present moment gives you the ability to self-reflect and see that. If you haven't got that, it's very, very difficult to live your life wisely. So the first noble truth, I think, is it was a wonderful thing the Buddha did in putting that, what might seem to be quite a negative way of seeing things, just to say that, you know, everything is unsatisfactory in the world. And, you know, he saw that because he could see that everything's tied up in these dualities. You know, he could see that because you can't kind of go and grab onto any creation without having the opposite of it. You know, so if you're going to go for good, you've just naturally got to have bad. It's the way that the universe works. You know, everything is in balance. So, and this is true both physically in the universe, where the universe is made of matter and antimatter, and it's and even the components, the components of the earth, they've all got their anti-partners, like positrons and electrons are a pair. And even in the psychology of things too, I mean, Jung and all of those really clever psychologists, whenever you talk about anything in the mind like this, he was always bringing up the shadow side. So that's always there, no matter what we do. And this is really why the Buddha pointed to all this as being dukkha, the world as dukkha. It's a good word to use, actually, because it's pretty hard to translate, really, just to, you know, you can come back and say unsatisfactoriness or just dis-ease, not peaceful. But it really is only when you start to go deep into the present moment and you can start to feel the subtlety and the joy of the way that this works. This isn't going through the seven factors of enlightenment again. The first one is mindfulness, and then investigation. And then the third factor of enlightenment is energy, because once you get that there, the energy becomes right. And then the fourth factor is this rapture and joy that comes. You get that factor working, and you can see it. You know, hopefully you even got a glimpse of it tonight in the meditation, as the mind becomes still and content. Just that joy and rapture. And then the fifth foundation of, or the fifth factor of enlightenment is just where everything becomes tranquil. There's a tranquilization, everything is tranquil. Just absolutely starts to become so peaceful and joyful. And then concentration can really go deep. So concentration then really hits. This is real samadhi. Then you're really going deep into the present moment. And then the seventh factor of enlightenment is equanimity. And that's sometimes difficult to see, because, you know, you really go right into the heart of the present moment. You're going into this place where the Buddha talked about, when I was talking about that verse 21 of the Dhammapada, you know, when you this is what he saw in there, right in the heart of this equanimity that's there. Just the, in actual fact, what it is stopping. The Buddha talks about it as being cessation. It's where things cease. But it ceases nowhere else but right in the heart of the present moment, right in the heart of balance. And it's sometimes difficult to think about that, really, just to think about what that means, because it's not exactly easy, really, to understand that balance and just what that means. In fact, even when the Buddha was asked about it, what is enlightenment, you know, he always maintained a noble silence, because it's really something that you cannot really talk about at all, because once you do try to bring it into words, you just kind of lose what it is. But it is right in the heart of the present moment. So I'll perhaps leave my comments there, and just, I'm sort of happy to answer any questions if anyone's got a question. I hope that that talk's been useful for you. And yeah, good on you, Eddie. It's not a night without Eddie.
Dennis, very interesting talk on how the mind works. You know, yeah. No, when you mentioned about the seven factors of enlightenment, first one, mindfulness; second, investigation of the Dharma. Mm-hmm. My mind was thinking of the press, you know, the news.
Oh yes.
Yeah, the news. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Don't you notice the last 4 years or so, that's full of all these fake news, you know. Fake news, okay. Then I was just, because they are trying to control, put out a cause, you know, okay. And one thing to make people believe them, you know, okay. So I was thinking of in terms of wisdom too, you know, okay. So the thing is, like, most people with one-track mind would believe in it. It's only those who have got wisdom can they investigate, you know. And comes back to the Buddha's teaching too, Kalama Sutta, do not just believe what people, you know. After only careful investigation, then you believe it. Is it too confusing? I was just thinking, like, how we've been manipulated, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, and how many people realize this, you know, that they've been manipulated, you know. So a lot of people are just like believed on the surface truth, you know, one track mind.
But Eddie, I think this is just the nature of the world, though. This is really part of the dukkha that the Buddha was talking about. You know, the fact that we might try as hard as we can to make this world perfect, but it is in actual fact impossible to do. You know, there is always going to be news, and who's to say anyway that any news is the correct news? I mean, we basically know. I mean, we've got the scientific method, which is, you know, I think a sort of a wonderful thing. And this is really just where you hold yourself open for your mind to sort of change. Into when there's new data or fresh data that's showing that what you've been looking at before is wrong, and that there's a more subtle way of seeing it, or a different way of seeing it. So you always sort of hold your mind open to that. But no matter where you go, really, there's always going to be this trouble. We try, you know, I've just been thinking even over the last century, you know, that since the World War, and probably the world's been as peaceful as it really as it has been for a long time, just right at the moment. But in actual fact, if you just think of all the wars and the killing and the trouble that we've had in the world, it just, and this is with the best will, you know, we've got the best will in the world to try and make things peaceful, but it's just not really possible to do. And I think that's what the Buddha was talking about with, and really what makes dukkha such an interesting thing to contemplate. Because we really can't, even, and we have got these minds that can create basically anything. We could, we can go to Mars if we want to. But why do we want to do that when we've got this world, and it's really quite a lovely world? You know, we could There's so much that we don't even know about this world. I mean, just what's at the depths of the oceans and all of these sorts of things. But even if you want to kind of get involved in sort of knowing all of that. But the Buddha was really more intent on just knowing his own mind, knowing where it begins and what and this process of beginning and ending. And all of that is, this beginning and ending that I've been talking about, is really just the second and the third noble truth. So you've got dukkha, which is the first noble truth, but the second noble truth is that conditioning has a beginning. So it begins as the breath begins, or a day, or you know, however you want to kind of construct that. This is all phenomena. And then the third noble truth is that it has an ending. But then the conditioning starts it again. So then it's back to the second noble truth and the third noble truth. Then, of course, the fourth noble truth is the pathway to see through all of this. This is the Eightfold Path. So it's just a wonderful way of... it's just got so much admiration for the Buddha for all those years ago. He was able to sort of see all this, as he says, in this fathom-long length of body. But yeah, thanks for your comment, Eddie. I understand where you're coming from. Yeah, yeah. It is very...
Can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
You know why I mentioned the prayers is because they can manipulate us, you know. They can create disharmony, you know, in the world. You know? There's already so much harmony, you know. It all comes from minds of people. Sometimes I was just thinking, you know, if we can get we want world peace, if we want peace, you know, if we can get those people with powers from these countries to think, please think more positively, you know, and together, you know, okay, unite together to give us inhabitants of the world peace. We want unity, peace, you know. And I'm sure if we have this unity and like good energy, you know, we can all conquer COVID easily. It just got no chance to arise.
Yeah, no, they're lovely thoughts, Eddie.
Sorry, this is my thing.
Anybody else?
Hey, Dennis, thanks for the talk tonight.
Hi.
I was just wondering, you touched on earlier when you sort of said in meditation and stuff, sort of things from the past can sort of resurface. And
can you just talk up? Yeah, just having a little bit of difficulty hearing.
Or is that better?
That's better, much
Hold
better.
A bit closer. You're saying in meditation things from the past can resurface and stuff when you're meditating and that kind of thing. I was just wondering if they're significant or whether that's just your mind sort of being a monkey mind again and distracting you. Does that kind of make sense?
So what your question is, how do you...
Or just whether it's significant.
The monkey mind, you mean?
Yeah, or whether, you know, when you're meditating, things from the past can sort of surface. You kind of mentioned it earlier and stuff in the talk. And I was just wondering whether those things are kind of significant or whether it's just your mind kind of being a bit of a monkey mind and distracting you.
Well, no, I think a lot of those things are embedded. They get embedded into the subconscious mind. And oftentimes these things can be really over many lifetimes. You know, I've certainly had many experiences within my hypnosis practice of people coming to me with situations that they can remember in lives long ago that it just suddenly fruited for them now. You know, like, well, I won't sort of go into examples because it just really... It's very, very compelling to talk about things like that, but it's, you know, I probably haven't got the time just to do that now. But there's many, many people that come with traumas that apparently come from a long, long time ago, or they can be just maybe the last life or the life before, or it could even be earlier on in this life. You know, when you're a child, things like that. Little things happen, these whether you're slighted in some way or been something happens that you don't process at the time. It just kind of goes in and stays, and it can often just stay there for sometimes for lifetimes. when the Buddha, the wonderful thing with the Buddha, because he had this still mind, and when the Buddha actually, the very first thing he did after he became enlightened was just really sit there and enjoy the bliss of the joy of this realization, the joy of enlightenment. And he just put that question into his mind, you know, what are my past lives? And then it was just like for him, I mean, it's quite extraordinary the way that the Buddha told that story, and or the way that it's recorded in the Buddhist scriptures, you know, that it was just like a movie for him. He was able to just sort of see one life after the next, and this caused that, and then so, this caused that, and then, but it was all there in his mind. So, yeah, I think they are important. They are phenomena, though. I mean, everything that the Buddha saw there, I mean, there's no necessarily any... They're all apparent truths, but not just in the same way that this world that I'm looking at here, I see that as this is apparently true. I mean, I'm not certainly not saying that that this night is not a truthful night. You know, we are living, we're all living this apparent truth that we're kind of experiencing here now. But there is a deeper truth again. Beyond all of this, you can sort of see more deeply into it. And that's really what the Buddha was able to do. Yeah, so I'd say it's important if you can see these things, you know, especially like with that in the meditation, as I was saying, because for me, as my mind settled and got more still, there were these kind of big things. Oh God, I haven't thought of that since. I remember that day. I remember that happened. And that fellow said that to me, or he, you know, or I had that fight, or I shouldn't have done that, or something that I might have said. I mean, this is really the story of anxiety and depression too, isn't it? The way that all of those, all of that sort of mental illness that we all seem to be, the world seems to be going into a little bit now. All of that really is involved in all of that too, isn't it? Just the mind not being able to let it go. So the Buddha was all about that, just teaching us all how to let go. Let go and stop. That's probably the... Let go into cessation. But it's not as easy. This is, well, it's not just so easy to do. But this is what we practice to do. It's a gentle inclination towards this truth, towards this understanding. The whole practice is like that. So,
cool. Yeah. Thanks, Dennis. Cheers.
Thank you. Dennis, I've asked this question once before to somebody, but I just didn't... It's a tricky question.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, how do we really know if something is a memory of a previous life, or is it a false memory that we've created? You know, just a story. Like, how do we actually... know the difference there?
Yeah. Sometimes there is, you know, even in my practice, oftentimes, you know, people will tell me the story, which I think is apparently right, you know, looks apparently true, but then they'll kind of come in and say, oh, I think I might have just made all that up. But the thing is, though, when something is coming out of the stillness like that, and you're not kind of, like tonight, you would have perhaps got a bit of an indication, hopefully, of what it is to provide a commentary or to think about what you're going to say. When you're thinking about what you're going to say, there's likelihood that you're probably going to be, you're thinking up a story. But when something just comes directly out of the stillness, when it just comes directly out without the ability to... of creating it, then it's more likely to be true. But the main thing though with memories like that is really the emotional charge that comes with it. That's how you know whether a past life memory or a thought is really there, because a lot of these people that I kind of see that are like that, that this is not just something that's they're just playing around in the head. Probably it's good to maybe just talk about that too, because there's really the two parts of what it is that makes up our humanity. There's first of all just the intellectual thing that's happening in your head, the way that you can think and making things up. But when that's happening too, there's all these chemicals being made in your brain. But usually when something is kind of really effective for you, what happens is that the chemical really gets quite strong, and then there's a charge, and that kind of comes to your heart. And then there's that charge is like is an emotional charge. And that emotional charge is what really tells you whether it's true or not, I think. You know, that's the way that it sort of works. When there's if it's just sort of an intellectual thought and you're not kind of following it through emotionally, it's not really, it's obviously not bothering you that much anyway. But when there's an emotional connection to whatever you're thinking, that's usually when there's something going on there.
So it's basically like the depth of its resonance. Is that sort of an indicator?
Sorry, what did you say? The life?
Oh, like the depth of its resonance.
Yeah. The emotional feel. You know, the heart. You can say heartfelt, because you know what makes us up as human beings, from the way that I see it, is this intellect up here, but also the heart. And when these two things are in balance, then you're it's the same with really everything else. When your head and your heart is in balance, you're living your life pretty truthfully, in a way. But you can use this intellectual stuff and not even be emotionally connected to it.
Yeah.
But some of the stories that I've heard, you know, from people who've had past life issues, the emotional side of what they express is really. I remember I was saying this at the conference. Actually, I know this is on YouTube. The conference there. This guy that came up to me from Bunbury, and he had this pain in his stomach, and he'd been to the doctors, and there was nothing really physically wrong with him. He hadn't really ever had anything wrong in that regard, and nothing they could find, but he knew that there was something. And he was only a young fellow, he's about just over 20, 21 or something, and he was a really hard client too. He was really difficult, he kept on just saying everything's black. I've got different techniques and ways of kind of trying to bring this out, but I was nearly at the end of my tether there. I'd sort of been nearly working with him for an hour, I think, nearly an hour, and he was still just sort of reporting things black. But I've kind of persevered and used these little methods that I've got of trying to get him to feel a little bit more. And then all of a sudden he's just lying there in the chair, and then all of a sudden he goes, ah! You know, this, I nearly fell off my chair. You know, he was that sort of frightening yell. They're just going, I've just got a spear in me guts. and then it was on, he was in the chair, he was on in his trance, but he was just, they're fighting over here, the ship's over there, well, I'm over there. No, I should really say the very first thing that he did say, though, was that he could feel himself rocking. He was in a hammock, and it was obviously in a ship's hammock, and he was just rocking. But then the blood-curdling scream came. But anyway, as usual, because when you're doing this sort of work, I never presuppose what it's about. I mean, it was fairly obvious that the spear in his guts was really where the trouble from his pain was coming from. But you usually sort of settle someone down again, ask permission to talk to their subconscious mind and let them explain what it means, because they certainly know what it means. And so he just sort of said, yes, it's this is the spear. And of course, the pain, you know, it was when I heard from him later, it was finished.
Yeah.
That trauma had gone. It was like a cathartic experience for him.
Yeah, that's interesting when you're talking about it as like a physical pain, because when you were talking about emotional charge, then my devil's advocate was saying, well, you know, what about those people that might have phobias of snakes or spiders, and there's such an emotional reaction from them, yet is that really reality? You know, the actual situation itself versus the way that person has magnified it in their own mind as being a threat. I wondered the difference between the resonance of truth of something that you know you've had in a previous life versus just an emotional reaction. Look, I don't know if we know the answer to that, but it's just something that is of interest for me to try and explore a bit further.
Well, I do think that phobias like that, they probably have a beginning somewhere. You know, and it might be difficult to find where that beginning is, but usually when you phobias like that, usually have, like I had a lady once that was frightened of snakes, but I knew she was coming, and I ended up sort of going out to buy a little rubber snake, because I mean she couldn't even look at a picture of a snake. So, you know, just by giving suggestion to her and helping her in that way. But in the end, she was able to handle the rubber snake all right in the chair, you know, so.
I guess what you said there about where does the phobia come from in the first place is probably the part that's worth exploring a bit more, because one child that's exposed to a snake, like child A and child B, they're not necessarily both going to develop a phobia, so.
And sometimes these phobias can come from something quite benign too, you know, you would think maybe they're benign. It might be a film or, you know, something like that, that or something maybe mum said to the child, and you know, that's given the child a fright, or that, you know, they can be very, they can be large or they can be small phobias, you know, but when they're habituated into the subconscious, though, they're there, and they, you know, they're real for the person.
Thank you for your time.
Yes, you got a microphone there? Virginia?
Yes, thanks for tonight, Dennis. I'm just curious, and I'm so pleased you mentioned the heart, because to me the heart really affects the mind incredibly, and you know, when the heart, as you said, when the heart and the mind are in balance, that really is, you know, what the Buddha is, more enlightenment than just the mind on its own. Did the Buddha talk about spiritual centers and the Kundalini energy at all, and opening the crown chakra and that side of that, you know, that whole idea that is in the Indian ancient philosophy, the Vedanta and all those? Did the Buddha actually talk about I think Ajahn Brahms talked about the Kundalini occasionally.
Yeah, well, I think certainly people have that experience. Look, to be quite honest, Virginia, I don't really know. I suspect that it probably was around in the Buddha's day, all of that stuff, because it's, you know, as you say, it comes from a fairly ancient kind of tradition. But I'm not really aware of the Buddha talking about chakras or things like that. Mm-hmm. But I still think that they're quite useful to incorporate into your, just the same as what I incorporate now, a bit of physics into. Because, I mean, obviously there's things that we know now that the Buddha couldn't have ever known 2,500 years ago. But even that in itself, I mean, he was able to sort of tell us things about this universe that even we've only just found out in the last couple of hundred years, really. Things like red giant stars and the way that systems, solar systems and so on finish. All of that was, he kind of saw all of that right back then, so.
All right, thank you, Dennis. Thank you.
All right, well, before, without further ado anyway, we'll just pay our respects to the Buddha, bow three times, and thank you very much for your patient listening and attendance.
Thanks. Interesting talk.
Thank you.
I like the topic on mine.
Yeah, that's interesting, I think.
Very good.
It's very good. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Eddie.
What the talk do you know? So you talk about the past life memories?
Yes.
From my understanding, if you're reborn,